Hi, and thanks for being with us for another edition of the Student Press Law Center podcast. In a second, we'll talk about a federal court ruling hot off the presses that benefits the rights of all college journalists to make sure that they can effectively distribute their product on campus. This month and every month, the SPLC brings you information about the latest developments that impact the legal rights of student journalists and journalism advisors. If you're interested in learning more, we hope you'll visit the SPLC.org website and consider becoming a supporter of the First Amendment's best friend on campus. I'm Frank Lamonti, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center, and we're here to talk about a federal appeals court ruling in favor of the student media that just came out October 24th, a ruling that limits a public university's authority to control the way news publications are distributed on campus. This case out of Oregon State University deals with interesting questions about how much leeway a college has to police the use of its own space when student publishers want to use that space to communicate their message. The First Amendment, we know, protects the right to publish news and information, but that right is meaningless without the ability to effectively distribute it to reach your audience. When schools and colleges interfere with the distribution of news and opinions, that interference can itself be an illegal form of censorship. But colleges do have some level of control over their physical space. You obviously can't set up a distribution rack in the president's office or in front of a fire exit or the middle of a sidewalk. And this lawsuit, OSU Student Alliance versus Ray, tests the limits of that authority. It began back in 2008 when the distribution bins for an alternative student newspaper called The Liberty started vanishing from the campus of Oregon State University. Well, to pick up our story from there and to explain the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision in favor of student publishers and what it means, we're going to turn to the lawyer who just won the case, Heather Hacker. Heather Hacker serves as legal counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom at its Sacramento Regional Service Center in California. Although the issues in this case were not strictly involving religious editorial content, the focus of the ADF is in litigating cases to protect the rights of Christian students, faculty, and staff at public colleges and universities. Ms. Hacker earned her JD from the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and she has been with the Alliance Defending Freedom since 2005. Well, we're very happy to have Heather Hacker with us here to tell us about the OSU Student Alliance case and about what it means for the rights of all student journalists. So thanks for being here, and I guess start us out with a little bit of background about this newspaper, The Liberty, and about how it came in conflict with Oregon State University.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me. The case really began, as you mentioned, back in 2008, 2009 in the winter, and the students had their distribution bins out on campus. They had 7 bins at the time, and they came back from winter break and discovered that all of their bins were gone. They had no idea what happened to them. One of them had previously been stolen on campus, and so they had taken to using a bicycle chain to chain the bin to a light post or something like that, some sort of stationary object to prevent theft. So they assumed, since they were gone and no one had said anything to them about it, that someone had stolen them. So they actually contacted the campus police. The campus police did a full investigation and, lo and behold, found out that it was actually the University Facilities Department who took the bins without notice to the students. The students then contacted the Facilities Department seeking an explanation for this, and the Facilities Department told them that they were following up on a policy that they had enacted a couple of years ago in order to, quote-unquote, clean up the campus, and stated that there were a few problems with where the Liberty's bins were. You know, they didn't comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act, and essentially they were trying to clean up the clutter on campus. Right. And students could go and retrieve their bins as they had time. When the students arrived to retrieve their bins, they literally found their bins thrown in a heap next to a dumpster in a storage yard. One or two of the bins was damaged and broken. There was a total of 150 copies of their newspaper that were damaged due to water. The little doors on the bins had fallen open. All of those copies of the paper had been ruined. And so the students were really appalled at what had happened to them and started asking some questions as to why did this happen? Why was this policy only enforced against us and not against any of the other papers on campus, namely the Daily Barometer, which is the sort of mainstream daily newspaper, student newspaper on campus, especially given that the Daily Barometer has 3 to 4 times as many distribution bins on campus as the Liberty did, which you would think would be relevant if the university were actually concerned about clutter on campus.
Right.
So the students really weren't receiving any satisfactory answers from the university. They were repeated the line about the clutter on campus. The students asked if they could put their distribution bins back out. The facilities department refused them. They said they could only place bins in 2 locations on campus, and essentially they were both right next to the student union. So they were restricted to basically 1 location on campus for those outdoor distribution bins, which is obviously a big problem for a newspaper that's trying to distribute viewpoints to the student body. The students kept pushing. They asked about, you know, well, when does this policy arise? You know, why are we being treated like this? And the university came up with another explanation, which was, oh, well, we can't, because you don't receive student funding, and the Barometer is the quote-unquote official newspaper of Oregon State University, we don't have the same kind of communication ability with you as the Daily Barometer, and therefore, you know, we couldn't have your bins on campus anymore.
Right. So there's no question that, I mean, they acknowledge that they treated the Liberty differently than they treated another newspaper that had been sitting, in some cases, literally side by side with the Liberty's bins, and they're trying to justify how did we single you out for this differential and unfavorably differential treatment. And in fact, these are their excuses they offer.
Right, exactly. And, you know, one thing that they did tell the students also was that they refused to acknowledge that the Liberty was actually a student newspaper. They kept referring to them as an off-campus paper, which is false because, and the students repeated this several times to the administration, you know, that they were a registered student organization. The paper was entirely written and produced by the students, published by the students. The only thing was that because they were an independent student newspaper, they didn't want to take university funding, so they didn't apply for student fee funding, but they were eligible to receive student fee funding just like all the other RSOs. So that was another sort of explanation about the university as to why the Liberty was being treated differently, even though it really was factually inaccurate.
Sure, sure. So the students go to court, take this case to federal district court, and interestingly, a number of the claims, we think of this as a First Amendment free expression issue, but a number of the claims arise under due process, and the due process clause instead, namely, you took away my property, that is both my bins, and also destroyed a bunch of my property, destroyed my newspapers, and did it in reliance on a policy that was not consistently enforced, and that I gather wasn't necessarily existent in writing anywhere, may have mostly existed in the heads of the people doing the regulating, right?
Yes, that's true. The university actually did acknowledge that their policy was unwritten, so there was no written record of the policy at all, even though they did claim that it was an official policy. The students tried to work it out with the university. The university refused to consider any of their proposals, and so we were forced to file the lawsuit, and a couple months after we did file the lawsuit, the university actually did change their distribution policy and allowed the Barometer to have equal distribution rights with the Daily Barometer, so we were pleased about that, but unfortunately, that did not take care of the fact that, as you mentioned, the students' due process rights had been violated by the seizure of their property without notice. The fact that their bins were, you know, off campus for a period of months while the university was stonewalling against the students and not giving them equal distribution rights, and the fact that their bins had been completely removed from campus during the period where the students had no idea what happened to them. So, you know, there were some significant constitutional injuries that the students had sustained as a result of this action by the university.
Right. So the case goes to a U.S. district judge in Oregon, and the initial decision comes out unfavorable to the students. Can you explain briefly the basis of that decision?
Yes, the initial district court decision granted the university's motion to dismiss our claims on the basis that because that you know the court was really looking at the constitutional violations in a very simplistic way and was only considering the actual taking of the bins from campus as the constitutional violation, which is not correct for many reasons. But because that was the way the court was looking at our claim, it said that the only people that could be individually liable for that action were the actual facilities persons who took the bins from the campus.
Right.
Now, obviously, we don't know who those people are.
Right.
You know, the whole point is that they took them, you know, in the like a thief in the night, you know, and we didn't have any way of figuring out who those people were. So we couldn't have named them in the complaint. Rather, we named university officials who had the responsibility of creating and enforcing policies on campus and officials who were made well aware of the problem after the initial taking and not only defended the taking but continued to state that the liberty would not be treated equally as the barometer and continued to enforce that exclusion from them from most of the campus. So
right. So obviously, and your interest is not in going after some poor guy who works as a groundskeeper making minimum wage who was told by his supervisor to go pick these bins up and throw them in a dump. You're interested in getting at the policymakers who made this quote-unquote unwritten policy, and that's one of the interesting overarching legal issues in the case is at what point does somebody become liable for a policy that's maybe implemented by somebody three or four rungs down the road, but at what point can a policymaker be held liable for the fact that a policy was being carried out in an unconstitutional way on their watch and under their responsibility? So, go ahead with the story.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. I mean, the whole thing with this case was that it wasn't, you know, the university administrators, once being questioned, had said, we have no idea why this happened. This must have been some sort of rogue facilities employee that took these bins. We didn't tell them to do that. We're very sorry that this happened. Here are your bins, you know. They didn't say that. They said, oh, yeah, this is our policy.
Right.
So it was never a question of what an individual facilities employee did. That was the official policy of the facilities department, and then it continued to be enforced by the president and vice president of the university.
Right.
So thankfully, after that ruling, which we obviously disagreed with, we appealed the decision to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Ninth Circuit actually ruled in our favor, as you mentioned last week, and the Ninth Circuit held that we not only had showed clear constitutional violations, I believe the court said it was very easy to find constitutional violations in this case, but it also held that the university administration, including the university president, could be held liable under the facts that we had stated in the complaint, because it properly recognized the scope of our constitutional claims. And it said that given the fact that the higher-up officials were involved in the denial to the students to continue to place their bins where they had them and continued to tell them they could only put them in that limited area around the student union and continue to tell them that they would not be treated equally as the other student publication on campus, that because they were involved in that, and essentially also ratified the action that the facilities department took in removing the bins, that was enough to state a claim against those university officials. And so what that means legally is that the university president and the other higher up officials are liable in their individual capacity for damages.
Right. And this is, I mean, I think this is a really important point, not even just for journalists, not even just for students, but it's really a point of broader importance for anybody that feels like they've had a constitutional injury at the hands of a government agency. Ordinarily, since you under law cannot get money damages, cannot get a state government agency like Oregon State University to actually cut you a check for damages, the only way to get any damages at all is to get at the individual decision maker who violated your rights. But when you have a decision like this where it's not clear who actually gave the order, responsibility may be two or three layers removed up a chain of bureaucracy, it's sometimes really hard to kind of pin the tail of liability on the right person. And so this decision, it seems to me, interested in your thoughts and your take on it, it seems like this is going to make it much easier going forward for a person who is whose rights are injured to be able to get some compensation against a government agency, frankly, even if they don't know the exact person who gave the order to engage in the unconstitutional behavior.
Yeah, I think that's true, and it is very significant for, as you mentioned, not just college journalists, but anybody whose rights have been violated because of that. You know, the court kind of took into account that, you know, while you do have to plead a plausible claim in order to state a claim under the law, that you know, there are certain things that you just can't put everything in. You know, the whole point is that when you filed the complaint, you haven't gone through discovery yet. You don't know all the facts yet. You're basically putting your best effort forward as to something happened here and it's wrong and we deserve to be able to litigate this case against them. And so the court kind of recognized that yes, there will be necessarily limitations involved in what the plaintiffs know at the time that you file a complaint, and they shouldn't be thrown out of court because of that. Essentially, they should be given the chance to prove up their claims through discovery. And so, as you mentioned, that's very significant to plaintiffs everywhere who could be bringing constitutional claims against government officials.
Right.
You know, we were very pleased with this ruling in terms of student rights, however, because this is a recurring problem. A lot of times getting damages against the university is sometimes the only way that we can get recompense for the constitutional violations that occur on campus, because oftentimes the other type of relief you can get, which is injunctive relief, a lot of times that's mooted because students will graduate or universities will change the policy midway through the case. And so, you know, the damages in this situation, they're not really, you know, we're not talking millions of dollars here, you know, for the student group. It's really kind of a nominal amount of money. But that money is what the courts have held as symbolic in terms of, you know, you can't really put a price on your constitutional rights, but they're important nonetheless. And so even though it's a nominal amount of money that you're talking about here, that is the recognition that you get from the government of, yes, you know, the acknowledgement that we violated your constitutional rights. You know, your rights are sacrosanct, and we have the responsibility of respecting them. We didn't in this case. So,
I think that's very important, because we've seen in the student journalism context time and time again that the student journalist graduates, and just as you say, the normal remedy that you get when a court finds that your First Amendment rights were violated is an injunction that says stop violating this person's First Amendment rights. Of course, if the person's already got their diploma, they've left, they have no intention of coming back, then that injunction is meaningless, and often that winds up mooting out the case and resulting in it being dismissed. So the ability to get that money, even if it's just a token send a message amount of money, can be really important so as to make the university feel the sting of a wrongful decision even after all the other possibilities of relief have been mooted out. So I think that's quite important.
Yes, definitely. And also, it all, you know, because it allows us to litigate the case to a conclusion and receive a court opinion on it, it allows us to be able to create precedent, as we have in this case, that will help other student journalists at other schools be able to protect their rights as well. And so
right.
That's really a huge benefit.
Right. Well, so just so folks understand procedurally where this case stands. So we have a ruling from the Ninth Circuit, and I guess I should say that there is the possibility of seeking review from the full bank of judges in the Ninth Circuit. There was a dissenting opinion. It was a 2-1 ruling by a panel of the Ninth Circuit. Sometimes when you have a split of opinions like that, that encourages a court to consider it as a full court in bank. Any thoughts about that, about the prospect of having it reviewed in bank?
Well, the defendants in the case actually have filed a motion for an extension on the deadline for filing for rehearing.
Mm-hmm.
So they won't be, if they do file for rehearing, it won't be until the end of November, I believe, if their motion is granted. So I guess they're at least thinking about it, but, you know, in terms of whether rehearing will be granted, I'm not sure it will. You know, there was a dissenting opinion in the case, but it is also important to note that the only portion where the dissenting judge departed from the majority was the claims against the university president and the university vice president, but she did, it was 3-0 as to the liability of the facility's director,
right,
for the violation. So, you know, it was actually a 3-0 ruling that we had stated claims at least against one university official. So because of that, I think, you know, it might be unlikely that the court will grant review, but it's hard to say exactly what will happen.
Yeah. Well, even assuming this were to hold up as the ruling of the court, you're still at the stage of the case called the motion to dismiss, which is really the very earliest stage in a civil lawsuit. The defendant, in this case the university and its administrators, will often file a motion to dismiss, which says that your complaint as you filed it just doesn't state a claim at all, that there is no constitutional right or no remedy for the wrong that you're alleging, and so the case should be dismissed without even, as you mentioned, going into the discovery phase. So here we are. Now let's assume that the Ninth Circuit panel opinion holds up. What happens now, and where does the case go from here?
Well, the case will be remanded back down to the district court, and it, as you mentioned, you know, it's really at the preliminary stages right now, so it will proceed through the litigation process as it would have normally. So we would enter the discovery phase, we would get documents from the defendants, we would depose all the university officials, and then we would either file motions for summary judgment or we would proceed to trial. And so the students have essentially earned the right to their day in court. That's what the ruling represents. And it's, you know, I feel like it's significant for these students because, you know, they really were treated poorly by the university, and it really was an injustice that their claims were thrown out so cavalierly initially. But now that they've earned their day in court, you know, they'll have the chance to present the claims against the university. And, you know, based on what the Ninth Circuit said about the ease with which they found constitutional violations in the case, you know, we're confident that we will be able to prevail ultimately once the case is litigated to conclusion.
Great. Well, we will definitely be following the developments in the case. And with that, I would like to thank our guest, Heather Hacker, and thank your organization, the Alliance Defending Freedom, for taking on this really important case and spending what has already been several years of time with a case that's already about 4 years old, with more to come. Thanks for your terrific explanation of the OSU Student Alliance case, and also for sticking with it being such a strong advocate for the rights of these students. If you are interested in following the OSU Student Alliance case and understanding more about what it means, we hope you'll check out the splc.org website, and that you will follow the SPLC on Twitter, become a fan of the SPLC on Facebook, and use the Student Press Law Center's attorney hotline, 703-807-1904, if you've got any questions about your legal rights as a student journalist or journalism advisor. Thanks for listening, and tune in next month.